Well, I'm here today with Mike Lycona, who heads up the apologetics area here at the North American Mission Board. And Mike, today we're going to be talking a little bit about biblical scholar Bart Ehrman, who has really splashed on the scene, very popular guy right now, several New York Times best-selling books. And he really has kind of systematically taken apart a lot of the New Testament over the last few years and brought up a lot of arguments for why certain parts of the New Testament are not valid and called into question just a lot of it. But I guess one of the important points to make is that a lot of what he's talking about and bringing up, these really aren't new arguments. These are things that you've seen before.
Yeah, and, you know, Mike, back in the 1990s, so this has been going on for maybe 20 years, this big stuff in the media. About 20 years ago, you had a group called the Jesus Seminar that came on the scene that really made it in the media at that point. And what made them popular was they did some interesting things. It was a group of maybe 70 scholars or so, but they were on the real radical left, the fringe of skeptical scholarship. And they did some things where they judged the sayings and deeds of Jesus in the New Testament, and they would take these votes using colored beads. So if they thought that Jesus actually said or did the thing attributed to him in the New Testament, they would drop a red bead in the bucket as it went around. And if they thought that Jesus probably said or did something like's reported in the New Testament, then they would drop a pink bead in the bucket. If they thought, well, no, he probably didn't do anything like this, it was a gray bead, and if he didn't say or do something like this, it was a black bead. And what was interesting is they ruled out like 80 to 90% of what we find attributed to Jesus in the New Testament. They said he didn't say or do these things. And what made him popular with the media, not only were they very skeptical, and for a secular media, this was very attractive, but they could say things in shocking ways and with sound bites, in the form of sound bites. So this was really good for media presentations, and so they were used a lot, quoted in magazines like Time and Newsweek, U.S. News, even Popular Mechanics got into the thing back in the 90s, and television programs, documentaries. But I guess into the early 2000s, the mainstream secular media discovered that the Jesus Seminar are nowhere close to representing mainstream, even mainstream skeptical scholarship. Mm. So they're rarely quoted anymore in that sense. A few years later, I think it was 2005, the Da Vinci Code came out, and that raised a lot of questions that came up, but some bizarre things such as Jesus was married and had children, or that the doctrine that Jesus is God wasn't even known until it was invented at the Council of Nicaea in 325. And these were just softballs thrown I loved fielding these things. It was great. And I guess, you know, it was a great selling book. The movie was a pretty good success. But, you know, even the secular media and the skeptical scholars that they interviewed came out and said that this was all just bogus history. It didn't happen this way. This is complete fiction and it's false. And then I think the year after that, the Gospel of Judas came out from the National Geographic Society, mm-hmm. and they wanted to make a thing out of it. Could this have been an alternate Christianity that was more true than the original? And pretty much that just kind of blew out of the way because it ended up being a Gnostic document from the middle of the second century. And then the year after that, I think 2007, you had the family tomb of Jesus, where James Cameron, who was, I think, the director or producer, something like that, of the Titanic movie, he funded a team led by Simka Jakubowicz, who's an amateur archaeologist, even says he's not an archaeologist, and a guy named Charles Pellegrino, who is a scientist and novelist, also not an archaeologist, who claimed that they had discovered the bone boxes in which the skeletal remains of Jesus, his wife Mary Magdalene, and his son Judah were buried. Hmm. And I think there was only one scholar in the entire universe who bought into it. Even non-Christian scholars said it was archaeology of the worst kind. And so that was very short-lived. Bart Ehrman's kind of the new kid on the block. I mean, actually, mm-hmm. he's not so new. He's been around for a while. He's in his 50s, and he's a pretty good scholar. Most of his stuff has been used, like his New Testament introduction, and lost Christianities, lost scriptures have been used for college courses and things like that at UNC Chapel Hill and some others. But he's been writing some more books that have gone in geared more on a popular level, and that's made him real popular. And so it's his day now. And Ehrman's day will pass, just like everybody's day passes. But he's a greater threat, I believe, to evangelicals right now, because his views aren't nearly as bizarre as the others. And they're supported by a greater majority of scholars than the others, which hardly got it, had any support. I mean, they are answerable, of course, but I think it makes him a little more dangerous. And he's a scholar we definitely need to respond to.
And he's a scholar that's managed to make the jump into popular media. What do you think it is about him that has made him so popular with the media?
Well, he's a really good public speaker.
Yeah.
You know, he is. And I really admire his writing style. He has a good style that makes it fun to read his books. Mm-hmm. And he's got a good way, just like what the Jesus Seminar did, he has a talent for putting it in sound bites that's really good for the media presentation, and he's got some good shock value to the statements he makes.
Mm-hmm. He knows the theatrics of it a little bit. Mm-hmm. Well, you've debated Bart Ehrman before, so you've met him, you've interacted with him a little bit. Tell us just a little bit about his background and what kind of a guy is he? Because it's easy, I think, for evangelicals, especially, to look at folks like this that are poking holes or trying to poke holes in Christianity or the New Testament, and to really see them as just almost this monster. But you've met him personally. Tell us a little bit about him.
Yeah, you're not going to find me demonizing him in any sense. I like the guy. I mean, he came from an evangelical background. I think he became a Christian in his teens, mid-teens, went to Moody Bible Institute, where he says where Bible is their middle name. And then from there, he went to Wheaton, which is a very strong academic Christian university.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, he went to Princeton Theological Seminary, where he did his PhD under Bruce Metzger. But during his time at Princeton, he was challenged on his views about biblical inerrancy. He ended up giving up evangelical Christianity because he couldn't answer some of the differences in the Gospels that really troubled him. It's almost like he was a black and white thinker, and it's either 100% correct or it's all incorrect. And he gave up evangelical Christianity, and then it was after that that he gave up Christianity because he couldn't handle the problem of evil. That really troubled him. But he seems to me to be a good guy. We've had a couple meals together. We've corresponded in email a number of times. And he seems to be a nice guy. I like him.
Well, I think that's great that you can have that, you know, kind of approach and attitude towards someone who's taking a very opposite view of yours. One of the things that's so frustrating when you read some of the media coverage about him is they quote him extensively. They have his views in there. And then they don't bother to go and get anyone like you or Lee Strobel or some of these other folks that are doing great work in this field on our side of the issue. Does that frustrate you? And why do you think that's happening so much, especially with him? It's almost like they allow him to tell his side of it and our side of it both.
Mm. Yeah, it is a little frustrating. But, I mean, to think realistically, we are talking about a secular media.
Right.
And whereas, let's say, in the Reagan days, it was popular to be an evangelical, that's no longer the way it is. We live in a post-Christian culture here in North America that's becoming increasingly hostile toward an evangelical Christian view. It's pretty evident within the media. It's very evident within secular academic institutions. I mean, you know, we can document those kinds of things. So, you know, if you have a secular media that aren't sympathetic to evangelical Christian beliefs and values, you're not going to expect them to give it a fair shake on these kinds of things. I mean, they should, but it shouldn't surprise us or disappoint us too much when they don't. You know, if you look at reviews of his books, you know, all you have to do is just use the search engines and look at the reviews and by the secular media. And, yeah, they typically don't bring it a lot of at least a balanced view in. They might have a few lines from people who didn't agree with them, but it mainly focuses on his deconversion from Christianity now to what he calls himself, that refers to himself as a happy agnostic.
We're talking about biblical scholar Bart Ehrman and some of his more popular books right now. First of all, his new one, Jesus Interrupted, but then also Misquoting Jesus, really calls into question a lot of the fundamental things about the New Testament and the accuracy of the Bible. And Mike, one of the charges he makes is that some of the books of the New Testament are just out-and-out forgeries. Mm. Why does he make that? What's his evidence that he shows for that?
Well, I think he says like 18 or 19 of them are forgeries of the 27 books and letters in the New Testament. And, well, that is a gross overstatement. I think it's made for shock value, and he knows that. Biblical scholars over time, New Testament scholars, have disagreed or debated on the authorship of a number of the books and letters in the New Testament. It'd be a lot to get into all of them, so it's okay with you. I'll just focus on the four Gospels.
Sure.
The argument that he gives for that is that the four Gospels are anonymous insofar as in the original manuscripts of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, they don't have the title on there that says the Gospel according to Matthew, the Gospel mm-hmm. according to Mark, to Luke, to John, as we find in our New Testaments today. And he says the original manuscripts didn't have those titles on there, and nowhere within the body of Matthew, Mark, Luke, John do we find them as claiming to be the authors, like I, Matthew, wrote this, etc. Mm-hmm. So it says they're anonymous, and we really don't have any idea who wrote them. So he says they're forgeries.
Well, so what do you make of his arguments? What do you think?
Today, the majority of scholars, and I'm not talking about 90%, I'm saying more scholars than not, probably, mm-hmm. 55, 60%, would accept the traditional authorship of Mark and Luke. And even in antiquity, the earliest Christian sources report that Mark was not an eyewitness. He didn't follow Jesus or see him, but that he did accompany Peter, and that he wrote down the recollections of Peter. So, and Peter's the lead apostle mm-hmm. of the church. So that's pretty strong. Mm-hmm. Luke, it's never claimed that he was an eyewitness, but you have Irenaeus in the second century and others who say, and Justin Martyr around the middle of the second century, who say that he accompanied Paul. And Luke himself never claimed to be an eyewitness, but if you look at the first four verses in his gospel, he says that he went to the eyewitnesses and spoke and interviewed those. The academic term for that would be autopsy. He wanted eyewitness testimony. And so he goes to them and to the actual eyewitnesses. And Luke is known as a pretty good historian. He followed very carefully the standards of the first century to do proper historiography. So he's going with the eyewitnesses. So we have eyewitness testimony in Mark from Peter. We have eyewitness testimony in Luke from the apostles themselves, possibly even from Paul in his sequel, which is Acts. And again, more scholars than not, a small majority, though, accept the traditional authorship of Mark and Luke, and that's including skeptical scholars. When we come to Matthew and John, it gets a little more fuzzy. Matthew is the most hotly disputed of the four Gospels in terms of who wrote it and the traditional authorship. But, like Papias, who's writing around the year 120, 125, he even reports about Matthew being the apostle who wrote it. Mm-hmm. And you even have prominent scholars like I. Howard Marshall, Scott McKnight, Joel Green, who say that it's a reasonable position for the traditional authorship of Matthew. John is disputed among scholars. It has been for some time. Some say that he was John the Apostle. That's the most traditional view. But some say the beloved disciple was an actual disciple of Jesus. He wasn't one of the 12, but he was one that traveled with Jesus, a minor disciple, and he was an eyewitness. Mm-hmm. And if they dispute whether he wrote it or whether some of his disciples wrote it. But either way, you've got eyewitness testimony in it. So, even James D.G. Dunn, just within the last couple of months here in 2009, in his most recent book, says that that even Matthew and John, the most disputed of the traditional authorship of the four Gospels, he says the position of the traditional authorship deserves respect. And this is a major New Testament scholar who's saying this. So the thing is, it is not a foregone conclusion that no one knows who wrote the Gospels. We can't establish it with a high degree of certainty, but it's debated, certainly, but it's not like we don't have any idea who wrote these things. So
right.
I really think it's misleading to call them forgeries.
I guess having scholars say it's a reasonable position to hold to the tradition is about as good as we can hope for with some of the New Testament scholars out there. Well, we are talking about biblical scholar Bart Ehrman, and a lot of his books are very popular right now, and a lot of them on the New York Times bestseller list. And one of the things he calls into question with the Gospels, or one of the reasons he calls the Gospels into question, is because he argues, Mike, that the time frames just don't match up. That when those books were actually written, the supposed eyewitnesses couldn't have survived that long. So they couldn't have been eyewitnesses. First let's start with, how do biblical scholars go about determining when something was written? How do they kind of pin down the time frame?
Fair question. You know, first thing they probably look at is, are there any reports about when they were written?
Mm-hmm.
And Papias, I mentioned his name a little earlier, around 120, 125, he mentions that Matthew wrote his gospel while Peter and Paul were setting up churches.
Mm.
So that would have been during the lifetime of some of these major apostles. And Peter and Paul are both believed to have been executed around 64, 65, within 34, 35 years after Jesus' death. So that would have been Matthew before that, if Papias is correct on that. So that would be one thing. We do know, I mean, a lot of people have questioned Papias' testimony, and, you know, it's not an easy question. It's not a slam dunk one way or the other.
Right.
But it is, you just can't throw it out because it's pretty early. And Papias is probably too removed from the apostles and writing within 30 to 40 years of when these gospels are written. So, I mean, that's pretty early. It's pretty good. You would look at things such as authors writing in the early second century who mention the Gospels, and if they're writing in the early second century, you say, well, it's got to be before then.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're writing these, mentioning, quoting from the Gospels as something that has been around for a while, then it goes back a little bit earlier, you know? So virtually all scholars, not 100%, but virtually all New Testament scholars, most of which are quite skeptical, place all four Gospels within the first century.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, it's hard to give them more precise dates. I mean, there are different arguments that are proposed, but even evangelical scholars like, say, an N.T. Wright, or a moderate like Luke Timothy Johnson at Emory, or even some skeptical scholars will say, look, we go with the traditional dating of the Gospels, Mark at 65 to 70 A.D., Matthew 80, Luke 85, John 90 to 95, but they admit, they say, look, those are pretty much arbitrary dates, and we really don't know, aside from, say, in the first century, that that's when they were written.
Right. Are there other examples, though? I mean, the Gospels obviously get the most scrutiny. The New Testament books get the most scrutiny out there. But what about other historical figures or historical events? The histories that we have come to rely on, how close were they written to the actual person's life or the actual event that we're talking about?
Good question. Let's take, for example, Caesar Augustus. He was the greatest of all the Roman emperors. He
mm-hmm.
was the emperor reigning at the time of Jesus' birth.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the glories of Rome, the best days of Rome were under Augustus. And we have eight chief sources in antiquity that tell us about Augustus. Two of them were written during his youth. They cut off around the age 19 or 20. So that mm-hmm. leaves us with six primary sources that tell us about Augustus, about his adulthood, which, you know, most people, that's what you're really interested in.
Mm-hmm.
And of those, the earliest is a short funerary inscription of under 4,000 words. It was probably written contemporaneous with Augustus' life, probably at the end of his life or shortly thereafter. Hmm. Other than that, though, of the six chief sources that talk about his godhood, the next one you have is Plutarch, who writes 90 years after his death. Hmm. And then the other four that you have are written between 100 and 200 years after his death. So six primary sources. One's pretty contemporary with him. The other five, however, plus 90, plus 100 to 200 years after Augustus' death. Now, when you say that that is what historians have to work with the greatest of all the Roman emperors,
right,
and four biographies written about Jesus within, according to the standard dating, 35 to 65 years of his death, that's pretty good.
Right. It just makes the point that if we're going to call into question the facts of the New Testament based on what Ehrman's saying, then we have to call into question many, many, many of the historical figures and events that we've come to just take as this is how they happened.
Absolutely. So. And you know what's interesting? He raises in his discussions, he'll say that, you know, 65 years later, that's like reporting on World War II now. That's a long time. A lot of things mm-hmm. can happen in between. Well, you know, I got thinking about that and saying, well, okay, 65 years, that's the standard dating for John, mm-hmm. 60 to 65 years. But when you're talking about the synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, now Mark is written within 35 to 40 years later. Right. Now we're talking not World War II, we're talking Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And really, Mike, if there were three Vietnam veterans, if we sat down three Vietnam veterans and said, hey, tell us about some combat missions you were involved in 1974. Are mm-hmm. we really to say that that's really too long, that nothing they said would be trustworthy? I mean, let's even take the 65 years with World War II. If Ehrman really believes that, then he needs to contact the History Channel and say, stop!
Right.
No more sitting down these World War II veterans and talking with them. I mean, it's useless testimony. We don't want to watch any more of your documentaries.
Yeah, yeah.
But of course, he doesn't believe that.
And sometimes some of the best information we don't get until years and years and years later, when people are ready to talk about it, or when the gravity of it has really sunk in. So it's almost just the opposite of losing something with age. Sometimes we gain something.
Well, it's true. And one other thing I'd point out, too, is it's not like in this 35 to 40-year period gap between the death of Jesus and the first gospel we have. And again, I'm taking the standard dating. If Matthew was an eyewitness writing in the 50s, well, then we're less than 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just using the standard accepted. And again, it's arbitrary, but it's accepted by most scholars today.
Right.
So even if we're taking the 35 to 40 years, that is not to say that we don't have things in between to fill in the gap and that the first report we have was 35 to 40 years later by Mark. No, not at all. I mean, that's when the first written record we have. But you've got Paul's letters mm-hmm. that has some dozen certain allusions to the Jesus tradition, which was passed along very carefully. And you probably have echoes from another 30 or more, even 40 different sayings of Jesus from the tradition or Jesus tradition in there. So you can go back very close to the events itself. So that gap has been plugged in pretty well, a lot better than other things that we have in antiquity.
And like you said, that's just about the time things were actually written down. The oral passing down of the New Testament and the Gospels was also staying alive and taking place during this time. And that was a very carefully carried out tradition. It was something that was pretty reliable the way they did it.
Yes, it was. And I think Ehrman misses this. When he describes this tradition or the stories of Jesus being passed along, he describes it more like the game of telephone, you know, that we all played as a kid, where you whisper in someone's ear, and by mm-hmm. the time it gets to the back, you've got a different story or a couple different stories. And, of course, if that can happen within a room over a 15-minute period, and what happens when you cross languages, cross cultures, and talk in 35 to 40 years before it gets put into writing.
Right.
But I think, you know, of course, some of that happened. no question about it, you're going to have legend that develops over time in the stories that pass along about Jesus. But I think that's inaccurate by and large on how these stories are passed along. I think a better example would be like the forms in the martial arts. Now, I was a martial artist. I practiced for well over a decade. I had my second degree black belt in Taekwondo. I was close to getting my third before I blew out a disc in my back.
Wow. I'm going to be a little more careful around you.
No. But I had two very good instructors, Bob Fujimura, who ended up being an instructor for the U.S. Olympics in Taekwondo. Wow. And then a guy named Master Eun Sang Ki, who was an eighth degree black belt and had learned personally, been instructed personally from the founder of Taekwondo, General Choi Hun-hee, who invented Taekwondo in 1955. Now here's what happens. He teaches Master Eun. Master Eun teaches me. Okay, now the way it works in forms in the martial arts, a lot of martial arts that are far older than Taekwondo have been going on for centuries. Right. And these forms are passed along from instructor to student, instructor to student, instructor to student for hundreds of years, unchanging. Because it's very important that you keep these forms pure to what was originally given. And it's for the student to perfect their technique and everything about the technique. Mm-hmm. So when I received that from my instructor, he could say, "Hey, Mike, I'm delivering to you, I'm teaching you what I received from General Che," right, who was the founder of Taekwondo. This isn't centuries, this is 30 years when I'm learning these in, say, 1985. Mm-hmm. 30 years, or even less, after the originals came about. So I had a really good confidence that I was getting what had originally been invented. And I passed along to my students, I trained several to the black belt level, and I passed along to them what I had received unaltered. You couldn't alter it. So I think that what we are looking at when we're talking about the tradition of Jesus is closer to what we find is passing along the martial arts forms than we are talking about with the game of telephone.
Mm-hmm. And we were talking the other day, and you were pointing out the great care and accuracy that the New Testament writers took. You were talking about Luke, for instance, the extra efforts he went to in doing his work. Share some of those examples of what he did.
A lot of neat stuff. Craig Keener is a New Testament scholar and expert on this stuff, and he's just completed within the last year a commentary on Acts that's over 7,000 pages long.
Wow.
Now, and he was telling me about a lot of the details in Acts, small, seemingly insignificant details that can be corroborated as being accurate. Really small things. Let me just give you, he gave me a bunch of them, and he said, this is just a small sampling. And for those interested, you can go to, right now there's a book out that came out like the mid-1980s by Cullen Hemmer. It's called The Book of Acts in the Setting of Hellenistic History. And he's got a couple dozen pages in there of all these little facts that have been corroborated, you know, just little things. Like one that I like is like a tomboy title. Now, when you... Greek is a lot like other languages, like Latin and German and so forth, where you have, we don't have it in English, but you have nouns that are either masculine, feminine, or neuter. It has nothing to do with their actual gender. It's just, that's how they've labeled them. Mm-hmm. So house in Greek is a feminine noun. When you come to the term God, or any noun, Greeks did things a little different. They used what's called an article that many times would precede the noun. It would go with it. So if I were to be talking to you and addressing you, instead of saying, Mike, this is a fun interview, I'd say, the Mike, this is a fun interview. I'd have the article in front of it. The article always agreed with the noun itself. So if you have a masculine noun, say your name, Mike, would be masculine in Greek, then the article that went in front of it would have to agree in gender. It would likewise be masculine. And if it was feminine, like salvation, the word soteria, has a feminine. It's a feminine noun, so it has a feminine article in front of it. Hey, soteria. All mm-hmm. right. You always have the agreement there in gender. So when you're talking God, that's a masculine noun. You'd say ha theos. It's a masculine article with a masculine noun. If it's a goddess, it's feminine. So you'd say hey thea. Mm-hmm. All right. When we come to Artemis, the goddess of the Ephesians, we have a tomboy term. We instead of hey thea, we have hey theos. In other words, it's a feminine article with a masculine noun. Mm-hmm. Very unique. Mm-hmm. And you'd say, well, that's weird. We don't find that anywhere else. But it's abundantly documented in inscriptions in Roman Ephesus, where Artemis was the goddess of the Ephesians. So it's like, wow, this is pretty neat. And we find all these kinds of things, like really unique or peculiar titles of city officials and people who were in different places, that Luke got it right, down to just minor details. Or things like in Acts 18, I think it's verse 2, where Luke says that Paul had recently come into Corinth and he met Aquila and Priscilla there because Claudius had recently expelled the Jews from Rome. Wow, and then he moves on. Well, not even Josephus mentions the Jews being expelled from Rome. Josephus is a Jewish historian. But it is mentioned by Suetonius in the early 2nd century, a Roman historian, who mentions, says, at the instigation of Crestus, Claudius expelled the Jews from Rome. Just one sentence, but it's like, even on the small, insignificant, seemingly insignificant details, Luke gets it right so many times.
Right.
So a lot that could be said about that. It's really a lot of fun to study this stuff.
It really pokes holes in the arguments that these guys were just throwing things together or that they were just trying to make things up to support their arguments.
Well, let me throw in one other thing I think is even more important than what we're talking about with, say, Luke. You've got, because you could say, even though Luke got it right on many occasions, that doesn't rule out that he might have added things at times. Hmm. So you'd say, well, you know, how well did he stick to his sources? We can test that against how he used Mark. Most scholars believe that he used Mark, and Luke says that there were others who had written Gospels at the time. Hmm. So he probably used Mark. So the way that he uses Mark and potentially another hypothetical source called Q, we see that he sticks very closely to it. But there's something that's even more fascinating, and that talks about that gap between when the Gospels were written and when the events actually occurred. Mm-hmm. And that's back to that oral tradition that was passed on more like martial arts forms than we're talking about with, say, the game of telephone. And what you have with that is we got a perfect example in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. And what happens with that is Paul is addressing situations in the church concerning marriage and divorce. And toward the beginning of the chapter, he says, now, what if you're single? He says, look, it's a tough time. People are getting persecuted. Christians are getting persecuted now. So if you're single, my advice to you is stay single. You don't want to have to worry about your spouse. So this isn't a command. It's just my recommendation, my opinion. Then he goes on, he says, for those of you who are married, not I, but the Lord. Mm-hmm. And what he's saying there is, look, what I'm going to give you here is not my opinion. This is Jesus' tradition. Tradition that was passed along to me, that came from Jesus through his apostles, now to me, and I'm passing it along to you. And he basically says, don't get divorced. You know, it's wrong. Mm-hmm. But then he goes on and he says, okay, and what if you're married to a non-believer and that non-believer wants to stay married to you? Well, then stay with them. But if they want to leave, you're free to remarry. But when he's introducing that, he says, not the Lord, but I. Mm. In other words, this is not something that Jesus touched on during his ministry. And I don't feel the liberty, as some scholars would accuse Paul and others, of making up words of Jesus and attributing to him for authority purposes and given those to the early church when Jesus never really said that, but they would make up these words and give it of Jesus to answer a specific question mm-hmm. or a situation that came up. Paul's not doing that. And after that, he says, with this last one, not the Lord, but I, he says, and this is my command, and you are to pass this along to the other churches. So here we see opinion versus Jesus' tradition versus Paul's apostolic commands. And that gets really interesting when you're looking at those kinds of things, because Paul did not take the liberty to change the Jesus tradition. That was not to be altered in any sense.
Well, we are talking with Mike Lycona, who is one of the top apologetics experts in the United States and also heads up the apologetics area at the North American Mission Board. We're talking about Bart Ehrman, who is a New Testament scholar and has really hit it big in the last few years on the New York Times bestseller list with some of his books. And one of his books is described on his website, and it says that it makes the case that the Bible is riddled with inconsistencies and outright forgeries. And Mike, one of the things that Ehrman argues is that there are a lot of contradictions in the Gospels, and therefore we can't really tell if it's true or if it's not. Especially, he kind of zeroes in on the death, burial, and resurrection of Christ. What are some of the contradictions that he sees in that account?
Well, for example, he'll start off and he'll say, was Jesus crucified on the day of the Passover meal or the day after the Passover meal?
Mm-hmm.
The latter being what the synoptics say, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and the former being what John said. And he says, depends which gospel you read. Was Jesus crucified at 9 a.m. or at noon? Did he carry his cross all the way, as Matthew, Mark, and Luke say? Or no, part of the way, and then Simon of Cyrene carried it, like Matthew, Mark, and Luke? Or did he carry it all the way, like John says? The two thieves between whom he was crucified, did both curse him or just one? For that, he says, depends which gospel you read. When it comes to the resurrection, he says, you know, how many women went to the tomb? Was it just one? Was it just Mary, like John says? Or was it multiple women, like the synoptics say? And when they got there, did they see one angel or two angels? And when the angels told him he had been raised and to go tell the disciples, well, did they, like some of the Gospels say, or did they go away and say nothing to no one, as Mark says? And when Jesus first appeared to his disciples, was it in Jerusalem or Galilee? And was it all in one day, the resurrection, all the appearances in the ascension, like Luke says, or was it over a period of time, like the rest of the Gospels seem to imply? So he says, this depends which Gospel you read. So those are the kind of contradictions that he brings up.
Now, other scholars are certainly aware of these apparent contradictions as well. How much significance do they give these kinds of things?
Well, it depends. When you're talking about biblical scholars or New Testament scholars, if they're skeptical, then they put a lot on them. A lot of them will put a lot on them. Like, they'll say they're hopelessly contradictory, what some like to say. But when we're talking about professional historians who have been trained in the philosophy of history and historical method, those outside the community of biblical scholars who deal with non-religious issues, then contradictions are expected. Because there are different vantage points in which people look at, some of them are just perceived. Authors are being select with the things that they talk about. I mean, I could give you lots of examples, but they don't see these as major problems. And some, like A.N. Sherwin White and some others, have expressed surprise and shock at how biblical scholars are far more critical about things than professional historians would be. And that's because, again, biblical scholars typically don't study philosophy of history, historical method, and they are usually more attuned to the the myopic views of their particular skeptical subculture.
Right.
And it's those that make a big issue out of the contradictions, the purported contradictions. But typically professional historians don't make a big deal out of them, especially if they're in the peripheral details.
Well, what about within New Testament biblical scholars? Would the majority of them dismiss the Gospels because of contradictions like Ehrman has brought up? Or are the majority of them willing to look past those?
A lot of them are willing to look past them. Ehrman himself is. Because despite his hesitations toward the Gospels that he articulates, and I shared with you that he says, he still says that one of the most certain facts of history is that Jesus was crucified on orders of Pontius Pilate. So the same thing with the appearances. He still believes that the disciples had experiences that they believed were of the risen Jesus who appeared to them.
Mm-hmm.
So they're pretty much red herrings. They're meant to take people off track. But at the end, he grants a lot of the same things that a historian would in terms of what we can know.
Back to historians whom you say are a lot more comfortable and, I guess, used to contradictions like this in their work. Are there, in other historical cases of events that are pretty well documented, are there even similar contradictions there that eyewitnesses saw things differently or left things out or included things that contradict with each other?
A real simple case would be the sinking of the Titanic. Now that's within the last 100 years.
Right.
Eyewitnesses, survivors who were there, who watched it go down, some said that she broke in two, just and then she sank. And others said, no, the Titanic went down intact.
Now, wow, that's a pretty big difference.
Yeah, I mean, if you're there, this is the most frightful night of your life. You're out in the middle of the ocean. The water is extremely cold. You are watching loved ones and friends die before your very eyes. You're hoping you're not going to die. You're watching the ship go down. You're in a heightened state of awareness. You're not tired. I mean, you are, but your mind is really focused, and you're watching it. And some said she broke in two prior to sinking. Others said, no, she went down and sank. How do you mess that up? But they did.
Wow,
but in spite of that, no one concluded that the Titanic didn't sink.
Right.
So in terms of peripheral detail, we could say, we don't know that, whether she broke in two. I mean, we found out when we discovered in the 1980s when the Titanic was discovered. And then they found, it did break in two prior to sinking. But we didn't know for sure until then. So that's just a more recent example. There are others in antiquity I could give too. But.
Well, back to the Bible. As a believer and someone who believes that every word of the Bible is true, I'm not really even comfortable hearing about some of the contradictions that you just mentioned. You know, that was a pretty long list of contradictions. Mm-hmm. How, Mike, do you explain, you know, why would those happen?
Okay.
Is there a pretty good explanation for a lot of them?
For a lot of them, sure. Some of them are more easily explained than others, of course.
Yeah.
So, for example, did Jesus carry his cross all the way? As John said, well, John doesn't really say that he carried his cross all the way. I mean, you're left with that picture, but he could have simply omitted the carrying of the cross by Simon of Cyrene. It wouldn't be any big deal. It's one of those peripheral details, and you might have just left that out. Whether there was one or two angels at the tomb or how many women went to the tomb, if you read John real carefully, the first two verses of chapter 20, the resurrection chapter, John says, Mary went to the tomb, saw it empty, ran back, and told the disciples, they've taken our Lord, and we don't know where they've laid him. Who's we?
Yeah.
You know, we find a similar thing in Luke, where Luke says that when the women came back, Peter ran to the tomb. But then a few verses later, when the Emmaus disciples are talking to Jesus, they don't recognize him at that point. They're saying, the women came back and said the tomb was empty, and then a bunch of our own went out to the tomb to check it out. Well, you just a few verses earlier said it was just Peter. Well, it didn't say just Peter. You just focused and said it was Peter. So it's not a contradiction in that sense. And like with the appearances in Jerusalem, Luke is using a very common rhetorical or literary device called time compression or telescoping, where we can imagine one of those telescopes with the different segments and you collapse it down.
Right.
And what Luke is doing for purposes of economy, things that you and I do every day in our conversation, everybody does this in our conversations, we collapse them down for purposes to make it quick. And so Luke collapses everything, the resurrection, the appearances, the ascension, all on Easter. But it's obvious that Luke knows that it occurred over a period of time because in his sequel in Acts, the very first chapter, he says that Jesus appeared to them over a period of 40 days prior to his ascension. So there's no contradiction when you look at it that way. Now, again, some are more easily resolved than others. Some aren't so easy to resolve. But I'd also like to point out, even though I am a biblical inerrantist, that even if some of these were irreconcilable, all that would do would call into question some form, a wooden form of biblical inerrancy. It wouldn't say that the Gospels are not trustworthy. I mean, you wouldn't throw out any other book. Ehrman himself contradicts himself in his book on a couple of occasions. That doesn't mean we shouldn't believe everything he says. I mean, he brings up about the Syriac traditions about Judas, Didymus Thomas, in other words, Thomas being a twin. He says, why not believe this? Well, but then another part, he says, well, the reason we don't believe these is because these are late. If we want to know anything about the real Jesus, you got to go to the New Testament Gospels. This is not for theological reasons, he says. It's for historical reasons, pure and simple. Well, Bart Ehrman said both of those. So he contradicts himself, and that doesn't mean we throw out everything he says.
Yeah. Well, Mike, we've been talking today about Bart Ehrman, but there are a lot of critics and folks out there who are shooting holes in the Christian faith, or trying to every day. What's some of your advice for believers who want to maybe equip themselves and just better know the arguments so that they can push back against some of these criticisms of the Bible and the New Testament?
Well, there are a lot of great resources out there. We've created a website, 4truth.net. It's the number 4, not F-O-U-R, but the actual number 4, truth.net. And we have over 150 articles on there. My first debate with Ehrman is there in its entirety. People can watch that for free. A number of my debates are on there, but we've got interviews with leading scholars and scientists on there. It's translated in 5 different languages we have on there. So it's a great resource. I'd also recommend for people just getting started, you have Lee Strobel's resources. So he's got The Case for Christ, The Case for Faith, The Case for a Creator, The Case for the Real Jesus. He's got those in small group discussion with DVDs and participants' guides. These are really great resources. Those are great starting points. You know, you can get into more in-depth things such as, you know, I've got a book out. It's a self-study course on the resurrection, The Case for the Resurrection of Jesus, that comes with software, and Gary Habermas and I co-authored that. There's a lot of good books out there. A lot of good resources, and anyone interested in following up with these, well, the website would be a great place to start, but just great resources to help people out there.
And as the popularity of Ehrman's book attests, people really are interested in who Jesus was and the New Testament. So Christians, if they can really equip themselves with this information, have an opportunity to share a lot with people.